so far this year. No. Mars is going to be near to the moon in a few days, or right now maybe even. So that could be interesting to see, but because the skies are not clear, we cannot see this. And I think there's something left of the planetary alignment, because I did read originally where it was going to go to the end of June, but we're not seeing much because we can't see through the skies. There is an article that I found quite interesting. I didn't know they were going to do it this quickly, but NASA announced Artemis Concept Awards for nuclear power on the moon. So there's apparently a goal at the end of this decade where they're going to get something nuclear on the moon. I don't know if it's a nuclear reactor or not. But anyway, so I'm going to look at this article first. It is called, as I just read, NASA announces Artemis Concept Awards for nuclear power on the moon, dated June 21st, 2022. So June 21st is today, Tuesday. And guess what? I didn't mention yet, but I will now. It's the first day of summer. So I think this weekend there will be hotter temperatures in the 80s. I don't want to convert it to Celsius, but anyway, I'm still working on, my mind still works on the old Fahrenheit degrees and things like that. And for me, a distance is measured in miles. It's easier for me to comprehend, but I guess the new students that were introduced to the metric system when they were younger will get used to that. So anyway, this is, again, an article on NASA.gov. It says, NASA announces Artemis Concept Awards for nuclear power on moon, dated June 21st, 2022, which is today, the first day of summer, and it's called Release 22-062. So here there's an artist's conception of a surface power system on the moon. It could provide reliable power for human exploration of the moon under Artemis. So I was thinking about this thing about power and energy, because we are one day going to run out of fossil fuels, but people that can do this in other climates where the sun is out more than it is here, they could maybe in their backyard put a solar panel and charge their cars through that. So collect solar power and then charge their electric vehicles through that solar panel, whatever it's going to be. So here goes this article. Again, it's called NASA Announces Artemis Concept Awards for Nuclear Power on the Moon. And one thing that gets me quite excited about this is that, well, the moon's very close. We can come and go much easier than going to Mars. And I also thought, well, let's say this sample return program that NASA has, they're still looking for a way to bring it back to Earth. And China is apparently going to shoot for 2031 to do the same kind of thing. So let's say if the scientists said, yes, there is proof that there was life on Mars before. So what does that do for us? It doesn't advance us in any way. It doesn't make our, maybe it will just make us work harder to get to Mars to study this life that did exist on Mars before. But really, what's it going to do for us? We find out, okay, yippee, we found life on Mars before, so where do we go next? Maybe we research it more, but it's not going to be an instant benefit that we can use right away to do anything. It's just the fact that life existed there on Mars before, and I guess that's big for some scientists, because they can say, okay, we're not the only place in the solar system where life has ever been. But I think that they might find life on Mars, or it did exist before, and where astronauts or astronomers go from there, I really don't know what benefit's going to be. It's not like we can take this and use it as a benefit. So here's this article. NASA and the U.S. Department of Energy, DOE, are working together to advance space nuclear technologies. that agencies have selected three design concept proposals for a fission surface power system design that could be ready to launch by the end of the decade for a demonstration on the moon. This technology would benefit future exploration under the Artemis umbrella. The contracts to be awarded through the DOE's Idaho National Laboratories are each valued at approximately $5 million. The contracts fund the development of initial design concepts for a 40 kilowatt class fission power system planned to last at least 10 years in the lunar environment. Relatively small and lightweight compared to other power systems, fission systems are reliable and could enable continuous power regardless of location, available sunlight, or other natural environmental conditions. A demonstration of such systems on the moon would pave the way for long-duration missions on the moon and Mars. So I guess this is an important thing because wherever we go on Earth, let's say now, I'm at my table at home, I'm using the power of the computer and the power of my recorder. If I go out, I'm going to use my phone, needs power. Car or bus needs power. If I take a bike, that's going to be human powered. But anyway, power and energy is such an important thing. And so this thing is moving in a good direction, I think. It's going to be useful. And if life is found on Mars, I don't know how useful it's going to be. What are we going to do with it? Other than to prove, okay, life exists elsewhere in the universe. Relatively small and lightweight compared to other power systems. Oh, I just read that. I'll read a new one. So says Jim Reuter, Associate Administrator for NASA Space Technology Mission Directorate, and quote, new technology drives our exploration of the moon, Mars, and beyond. Developing these early designs will help us lay the groundwork for powering our long-term human presence on other worlds, end quote. And on other world, let's say we talk about, okay, let's talk about the moon, but also Mars. So let's say Mars first. We'll talk about Mars. Now, if humans do get there, maybe 20 years from now, if they do at all, then there's going to be a need for a place to live. People can't just take off their spacesuits and walk around on the Martian surface. They're going to die. And probably it's going to be a very quick death. So you need habitation, lights for that, heat for that, and to power everything that we would need on Mars. So this is a very useful thing because we do use a lot of power on Earth. Battelle Energy Alliance, the managing and operating contracts for Idaho National Laboratory, led the request for proposal development of evaluation and procurement sponsored by NASA. Idaho National Laboratory will award 12-month contracts to the following companies to each develop preliminary designs. 1. Lockheed Martin of Bethesda, Maryland. 2. Westinghouse of Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. 3. IX of Houston, Texas, a joint venture of Intuitive Machines and X Energy. So we see that in terms of a lot of things to do with space, and one of the things I talked about last week and other weeks was the development of futuristic technologies, which the U.S. is way ahead of Canada, I think, with all these not only developing defense things, but also for NASA. So says Idaho National Laboratory Director John Wagner, and quote, the fission surface power project is a very achievable first step for the United States establishing nuclear power on the moon. I look forward to seeing what each of these teams will accomplish. And cool. So we can look forward to that people living on the moon, and they're probably going to get robots up there first to build these places where you live. And I've talked about, and NASA has talked about, lava tubes. They have lava tubes on the Earth, so they can work with those here, experiment with those that can be later used on the moon. And the Phase One awards will provide NASA critical information from industry that can lead to joint development of a full flight certified fission power system. Fission surface power technologies also will help NASA mature nuclear propulsion systems that rely on reactors to generate power. These systems could be used for deep space exploration missions. Now, I am not sure, because very often when these things are talked about, this kind of question, when is fusion power going to be developed? Of course, fusion power is very clean, doesn't have any reactive products that are nuclear and that could be dangerous. So you keep hearing a number like, oh, in 10 years, in 10 years, in 10 years. So who knows when nuclear fusion will be able to use nuclear fusion to do things. But that's a definite goal that would really benefit the whole planet, and that could be used on the moon and developed on the moon. And it's a lot safer if something happens and no one's on the moon. So, but someone will be on the moon within maybe 5 years, and astronauts will be able to shuttle back and forth to the docking station that orbits the moon and go down to the moon and do actual experiments and live there for quite a while, let's say maybe even 6 months. So this does look promising, this thing. The Phase One awards will provide NASA critical information from industry that can lead to a joint development of a full flight certified fission power system. So they're talking about fission power on the moon. Fission surface power technologies also will help NASA mature nuclear propulsion systems that rely on reactors to generate power. I probably read that before, so I apologize if I'm reading again. These systems could be used for deep space exploration missions. Interesting. NASA's Fission Surface Power Project is managed by the agency's Glenn Research Center in Cleveland. The power system development is funded by the Space Technology Mission Directorate's Technology Demonstration Missions Program, which is located at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. So I've never heard about this Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, but it just goes to show you how many centers like this that NASA has that develops and uses advanced technologies. So this is called the Research Center in Cleveland, or sorry, the Glenn Research Center. Of course, we all know of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Houston, Florida, and Huntsville, Alabama, and Seattle. They do a lot of defense work and probably also lots of NASA work, and in Colorado, in many states. The U.S. is just so really advanced in the use of this high technology, and I'm looking forward to a very robust future presence in space, because we have the low Earth orbit economy, International Space Station, all these telescopes, Artemis on the moon, thinking about Mars. There's lots going on, and the Hubble or the James Webb Space Telescope, not just going into space and doing something, but having a presence in space and mega satellite constellations. And wow, to me, I can't wait. Imagine today is June 21st, 2022. It's the first day of summer. Where will we be 10 years from now? We'll probably look back and say, wow, this era in June 21st, 2022 was so primitive compared to what they will have in 10 years. So, of course, I love astronomy, so it gets me excited to even think about astronomy. But all that the U.S. is doing and planning for space, with all these space centers, with all this advanced technology, and I did read something about some African country wants to set up its own mega space constellation of satellites up there with, I thought it was about 40,000 satellites. Imagine how crowded space is going to be eventually. And we're right in there because we're affiliated with NASA and the U.S. And look, they let us come into the James Webb Space Telescope. Canada built the Canadarm for the space shuttle, or for the International Space Station, was it? So there's so much going on in space, and it's just going to continue to get bigger and also more beneficial for people, because they're developing all these technologies that will help. And so many technologies, like Teflon from the space shuttle, we used for cooking. And there is going to be so much technology. There was refrigerating technologies, all kinds of other things that are going to be, and that have been, so useful, these technological spin-offs. I can't name them now, but I did a show about it about 5 years ago. So for more information about NASA's investments in space technology, visit www.nasa.gov/spacetech. So that is going to be, is an exciting part of NASA's future. Going more into space, using it to have a low Earth economy, that's going to be just amazing. What can they do in microgravity? And one of the experiments, or examples I mentioned a few weeks ago, was making telescopes in space. They just let the physics do the smoothening out of the mirrors. No need to polish and grind like we do on Earth. And I'm going to read an article about that in a few minutes. But anyway, this is exciting. So again, you're going to go, if you're interested in this stuff, and I will look at it myself, www.nasa.gov/spacetech. Very cool. And this is written, I believe, by, let's see who wrote this. Okay, at the bottom they have people that are affiliated with NASA. So here's one called Sarah Fraser, headquarters Washington, and it gives you her name, her number, and everything. So if you want to contact them, like I did a few times, what they do is they contact the people working on these projects, and they said, Marco wants to have an interview with you. So they set up an interview with you. Isn't that great? So there's Sarah Fraser, Jan Whitry, Joel Hiller, and that's what they have here for now. So go to this article. Again, it's called NASA Announces Artemis Constant Awards for Nuclear Power on the Moon. And it gets me so excited. I'm excited anyway, talking about space. But the plans that NASA have, that the U.S. have, they're really investing money and technology in developing space for our use. And this NASA Artemis program, not just the big first goals, like, let's say, get a person of color and a woman to set feet on the moon. Now, that's going to be exciting. That's going to be a goal. It's going to inspire a lot of people. But then the projects that they're doing up there, the projects that they'll do. And I remember maybe two or three months ago, they launched the spacecraft to go to the moon, and they're going to be drilling for ice. I think they're going to the South Pole of the moon and seeing, developing technologies so they could find ice and therefore have water for people that go on the moon. And if you think about this, it's going to be very cool. People will be living in these maybe lava tubes on the moon, and they're going to have robots working with them, and then they'll have to grow their own food on the moon. And I guess it's going to be a lot of vegetarian meals, but this is just so exciting that we're going out, because we are an advanced technological species now. We're going into space, and this is going to be so cool. So I was talking about the summer solstice. I'll read something about that when I get back, but there's also something about an advanced article on this thing I talked about before, where the use of space to develop telescopes is going to be a big thing in the future for NASA. So I am going to now go for a break. And of course, I'm going to talk a little bit about the solstice. It's just one of the regular things, these patterns in our life we get used to, the first day of summer. And hopefully, I think this weekend's going to be better weather. So when I come back and when you come back to listen, we're going to be talking more exciting space news here on AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I was just talking about the Artemis moon mission and all the technologies they're developing for that. And there's going to have a lot of spin-offs on Earth. But also, it's going to be a technology that they'll develop, like a nuclear power fission system on the moon. And you can imagine the moon, it probably doesn't have many clouds. They could probably also use solar power energy up there. But this article I'm going to look at now quickly is, the moon will swing by Mars early Wednesday morning as it continues its planetary tour. So right now, where I'm talking to you, it's 5:33 in the afternoon Tuesday. So that'll be early Wednesday. I'll tell you the time in a few minutes. It's by Daisy Dobrijevic, published 8 hours ago, so today is the 21st, so it was published on the 21st. The duo will be visible in the same field of view when using a pair of binoculars. The crescent moon approaches Mars in the pre-dawn sky on Wednesday, June 22nd. So here is the moon, and there is Jupiter, Neptune. I don't know if you could see. Neptune would be the farthest planet away, so you might need a real good telescope. And guess what? This planetary alignment is here, because they show Venus on the horizon, then Uranus, then Mars, the Moon, Jupiter, Neptune, and Saturn. Very nice planetary alignment. Let's see, I think the sun starts to rise these days about 4:30. So I think today will be the longest day of the year. And as we all know, from now on, the days will get shorter and shorter by a minute or a minute and a half or two. So anyway, just to repeat this planetary alignment, it's Venus, Uranus, Mars, the Moon, Jupiter, Neptune, and Saturn. It shows the constellations. There's Pisces, Triangulum, Cetus, and that's it for now. For Mahalt, that's the star. Keep your eye on the eastern sky before dawn on Wednesday, June 22nd, to see the crescent moon approach Mars as it continues its tour of the morning planets. So says Chris Vaughn, an amateur astronomer with Sky Safari software, who oversees space.com's night sky calendar. I envy that guy. He's got all this in his head. And I used to study the sky years ago, so I would have some of this stuff in his head. Probably not anywhere near to what Chris Vaughn has his head, but it was so interesting to look up in the sky and to be able to remember all these constellations and things. So says Chris Vaughn, and quote, the moon's pretty crescent will take a position a palm's width to the right of Mars's red dot. Bright Jupiter will shine off to the upper right or celestial west, end quote. And also, there'll be Neptune and Saturn to the upper west, and Saturn's a bit farther away. So if you get up early enough, and if you get a clear sky, you can see Venus rising as well. The pair will make for an interesting stargazing target, as they will appear close enough to share the same field of view in a pair of binoculars. They will rise above the eastern horizon about 1:56 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which is 4:56 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Those are aliens from Mars. Observers in the Southern Ocean region will also be able to see the moon occult Mars around 1800 Greenwich Mean Time, which is maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, according to Vaughan. Well, what he must have in his head in terms of knowing the night sky and all the constellations and planet. I wish I could do that again. The exact time of the event varies depending on your specific location, so you'll want to check out a sky watching app like Sky Safari or software like Starry Night to confirm the local time to look up. Our picks for the best stargazing apps might help you with your planning. Mars is the fourth planet from the Sun and perhaps one of the most distinctive planets in the night sky due to its famous red hue. It gets its color from the oxidation or rust of iron-rich minerals in its regolith, the loose dust and rock covering its surface. Hopping to capture a good photo of the moon, hoping to capture a good photo of the moon as it approaches Mars. Our guide on how to photograph the moon has some helpful tips. If you're looking for a camera, here's our overview of the best cameras for astrophotography and best lenses for astrophotography. As always, our guides for the best telescopes and best binoculars can help you prepare for the next great sky watching event. The Moon and Mars. Getting cozy isn't the only sky watching event to look for this month. Throughout June, a rare planet parade will be visible in the pre-dawn sky as all five naked-eye planets line up in the orbital order from the Sun. The left to right in the southeastern sky, you'll be able to spot Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn all in a row. Mercury is usually hidden by the Sun's glare, but it will become easier to spot as the month matures, something we're really missing living here in Vancouver. The best opportunity to see this spectacle may come on June 24th, as Mercury should rise about an hour before the Sun, according to press release from Sky and Telescope. Throughout June, the Moon will continue to journey past the morning planets, embarking on a planetary meet and greet. That's so cool, seeing how Moon will move from planet to planet. After Mars, the next stop on our tour is Venus on June 26th, then finally Mercury on June 27th. So this is a good article if you want to get information about viewing. It's the article's name is "The Moon Will Swing by Mars Early Wednesday Morning as It Continues Its Planetary Tour." Now let's see if I can hopefully get up and do some sky watching. But where I live, it's bit flat and there are trees on the horizon. So I live on the 11th floor and maybe I should just stay on my balcony and try to watch it from there. So this is an interesting thing that's happening that we are probably not going to be able to see because it is too cloudy. Okay, so I'm going to try to so here it is, an article on the summer solstice 2022 marks the longest day in the northern hemisphere. This is published by, again, Daisy Dobrijevic 15 hours ago, which means it's published today on the 21st. Summer officially begins today, June 21st at 5:14 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Huzzah! Okay, now it shows, isn't that nice? It is showing Stonehenge, and in the middle of one of the big pieces of the observatory where there's a couple of pillars, and a pillar on top, you can see the sun right in between that. It's just so cool how the ancients were able to build things like this. So from Stonehenge's circle of standing stones, the sun will rise directly over an ancient avenue leading away to the northern, to the northeast on the solstice. Stonehenge is located on Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, England. I was there in London and I said, wouldn't it be cool to see Stonehenge? And I never went and did it. So shame on me. Okay, summer officially kicks off in the Northern Hemisphere today, June 21st, marking the longest day of the year. During the June solstice, or summer solstice, the sun reaches its highest and northernmost point in the sky, delivering the maximum daylight hours of the year for the Northern Hemisphere and minimum daylight hours of the year in the Southern Hemisphere, according to Christian Vaughan, amateur astronomer with Sky Safari software, which oversees space.com's night sky calendar. So my sister is in New Zealand, so for her, I believe, this is the shortest day of the year. This year, the summer solstice officially occurred on 5:14 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, when the sun reached the point directly overhead of the Tropic of Cancer, latitude 23.5 degrees north. Now, years ago, I would have known what that meant. Now, I don't. In addition to the longest day of the year and the start of summer, the June solstice also occurs at the moment the northern half of Earth is tilted towards the sun, resulted in the northern hemisphere receiving sunlight at the most direct angle of the year. So I guess way up north, they're going to have 24 hours of sunshine a day. To determine how many hours of daylight you'll receive during the June solstice, you can use the Farmer's Almanac Sunrise and Sunset Calculator. I'll do that a bit later. As always, there are two sides to every story. While the Northern Hemisphere welcomes longer days and warmer temperatures, the June solstice marks the beginning of winter in the Summer's Hemisphere when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky. Throughout June, stargazers will be treated to other sky-watching events, including a rare planetary parade where all five naked-eye planets will be visible in the pre-dawn sky as they line up in their orbital order from the sun. From left to right in the southeastern sky, you'll be able to spot Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn all in a row. Mercury will usually be hidden by the sun's glare, will become easier to spot as the month matures. That's a good way to put it, as the month matures. The best opportunity to see this spectacle may come on June 24th, as Mercury should rise about an hour before the sun, according to a press release from Sky and Telescope. Throughout June, the moon will continue to journey past the morning planets, calling in on Mars on June 22nd, Venus on June 26th, and finally Mercury on June 27th. Be great if I could wake up all those days in a row. I don't know if I'll be able to, but that would be really cool to see that as the moon moves. Hoping to capture a good photo of the moon as it approaches the morning planets, our guide on how to photograph the moon has some helpful tips. Okay, so that is, first I talked about the planetary alignment. Now I'm talking about what's going to happen with the moon and the summer solstice. So we are progressing through the year and we're hoping for nice weather coming to Vancouver quite soon. That would really help in terms of being able to see things in the night sky or the morning sky, whatever you have, because we just don't have the weather to do all these things. So I will now talk about, what am I going to talk about? I had no idea. Oh yes, I had an article on space.com, so I'm going to go on to space.com. Forgive me for this, but I accidentally closed all my pages. And it's going to take a second to load space.com. So there we go. I had quite a few articles to readonspace.com. So NASA Artemis 1 moon mission passes crucial fueling test despite leak. Okay, so here is a beautiful picture from Hubble Space Telescope. What it is showing is Hubble Space Telescope Sea of Sequence image shows off a star cluster. Now, I went to a star party close to the U.S.-Canada border a few years ago, and there was a lot of people set up their telescopes. So one thing great about these things is you don't have to bring your own telescope. People drag their telescopes out. Big telescopes, which they have in their vans or their trucks, they haul them out, set them up, and then you can see. So I saw a star cluster, and I don't remember the name, but it was millions and millions of stars, and such a joy to watch things with your telescope. So this is by Elizabeth Howe, published 15 hours ago, saying Hubble Telescope Sea of Sequence image shows off star cluster, showing a full sky of stars. The globular cluster Tirzan 9 glitters in a new image from the Hubble Space Telescope. Globular clusters are groups of stars that number anywhere in the tens of thousands to the millions. So the one I saw was millions of stars, according to a June 17 blog from the European Space Agency about the recent image. ESA officials wrote that Tirzan 9 is dotted with so many glittering stars that it resembles a sea of sequins or a vast treasure chest crammed with gold. Yes, it does. It looks beautiful. The image is part of a Hubble Space Telescope program that is examining globular clusters towards the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. This area is rich in interstellar dust, making it difficult to see objects like stars. The dust, ESA said in a statement, absorbs the starlight and can even change the apparent color of stars in these clusters. Hubble is able to somewhat peer through the dust, as it can detect some infrared light, which, thanks to its longer wavelengths, can penetrate through certain dusty regions. Hubble primarily observes the universe in the visible light, which enables astronomers to learn how much a star's apparent color can change due to interstellar dust. So that's one of the things I heard about James Webb's telescope years ago, was it might not deliver, for example, Hubble sees invisible light and with visible light, so it might show more beautiful pictures, but in X-ray light or infrared light, maybe the picture won't be as beautiful. Knowing the true color of a star, along with its brightness, will better allow astronomers to estimate the age of individual stars of the globular cluster. At even wider ranges of infrared capabilities, an even wider range of infrared capabilities will be available when the Webb telescope comes online next month. Webb should release its first science-grade images on July 12th. It is located farther away from Earth than Hubble and has a much larger mirror. The $10 billion telescope will be able to see the most distant and oldest galaxies and star clusters that formed in the first hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang, enabling astronomers to answer fundamental questions about the evolution of the universe. So here's an article that says the Hubble Space Telescope and 30 years that transformed our view of the universe. So I think Hubble just recently celebrated its 30th birthday. And here's another one. Hubble Telescope spots a complex cloud of glass expanding into space. So that's what I usually found at space.com or livescience.com. They have a lot more links so you can delve further into or acquire knowledge of the topic that you're... So what I think I'll do, I'll go for a break now. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back. You're listening to Astra Talk on CITR 101.9. And, of course, I mentioned the related stories, but also there's another link here that says Hubble's greatest images of all time. So that could be useful to go to. Nice if you just want to spend some time looking at some beautiful pictures. The Hubble Space Telescope and 30 years that transformed our view of the universe. Hubble is here to stay. That's nice to know. In the beginning, it was just a large space telescope. Its mundane name, a marker of how very extraordinary an observatory it was. Decades later, it's simply Hubble, perhaps the most recognized telescope ever built. So, left Earth on April 24th, 1990. So, it's 32 years old. And it says here, Hubble is very human endeavor, and the related link I said was the best Hubble Space Telescope images of all time. So I'm not going to read this article itself, but here it says the Hubble Space Telescope and 30 years that transformed our view of the universe, published April 24th, 2020 by Megan Bartels. That's M-E-G-H-A-N. If you want to go there, you can look at some links that are very good, all these links. And I guess one of the greatest things about the Hubble Space Telescope is the images that can be seen with it. Okay, so I had an article here, and what happens, I have this computer that doesn't have much memory, so it will sometimes, the whole screen will just turn black for no reason at all. And so I'm stuck with that sometimes, and when I try to look for an article, then I can't find it because of how my computer is operating or not operating. So I was trying to find the article about, so right now I'm on NASA. I don't think it's going to be on NASA. I think it will be on space.com. Looking for, it's something I talked about maybe starting a few months ago, but I've touched on it quite a few times since then, was world's largest liquid mirror telescope ready to observe. It's by Stephanie Waldeck, that's with a K, published 9 hours ago. So it's published on June 21st, 2020. And the subtitle is, Astronomers Must Brave a 10-Hour Drive into the Himalayas to Get There. So here it shows the ILMT mirror during testing at Liège in Belgium. The world's largest liquid mirror telescope is ready to gaze at the stars. Located at the Devaltz Observatory in India's Himalayas at an elevation of 8,038 feet or 2,150 meters, the 4-meter International Liquid Mirror Telescope, ILMT, is the first liquid telescope to be built specifically for astronomy. Most telescopes use glass mirrors, but as the ILMT's name suggests, its mirror is made from a thin layer of liquid mercury that floats on 10 microns of compressed air and rotates every 8 seconds. So says, oh, look at this, Paul Hickson, an astronomer at the University of British Columbia, which helped develop the telescope, said in a statement, and quote, by way of comparison, a human hair is approximately 70 microns thick. The air bearings are so sensitive that even smoke particles can damage them, end quote. Nice to know that a UBC astronomer is. The rotation causes the liquid mercury to form a parabolic shape like a contact lens, which shape is what allows the telescope to focus light from deep space. In fact, glass telescope mirrors are also parabolic. but shaping a solid material requires far more effort. Thus, liquid mirror telescopes are far more cost-effective than conventional ones. So the ones I talked about before, the telescopes, the liquid ones were made out of water. This one seems to be made out of liquid mercury. The trade-off is that the ILTM is fixed in a single position, so it only observes one strip of the night sky as the Earth rotates below it. But since the telescope will be hyper-focused on just one area, it is well suited for spotting transient objects like supernovas and asteroids. So says Jean Sturges, project director and astrophysicist at the University of Leeds, Belgium. And quote, the collected data will be ideally suited to perform a deep photometric and astrometric variability survey over a period of typically 5 years, end quote. Expected to begin science observations later this year, the ILTM will operate from October through June annually, closing during India's rainy season. The project is an international collaboration between institutions in India, Belgium, Poland, Uzbekistan, and Canada. That's a nice combination. So this is about a liquid space telescope. So here's related stories in the side here. Related links you could press on. Hubble Space Telescope's largest ever infrared image peers back 10 billion years. Wow. Another one, China will launch a big space telescope in 2023 to investigate distant galaxies. And another one, a private AX1 astronaut will test making a liquid telescope mirror in space. Now that's just some of the cool stuff you can read on in this article, which is called World's Largest Liquid Mirror Telescope Ready to Observe. It's by Stephanie Waldick, published June 21st, 2020. So that is nice to know. Our technology is delivering all these astronomical technological devices that can be used in outer space. So now I will go to the other article I was talking about, was this mega constellation. And I think when they talk about mega constellation, that means a lot of satellites somehow working together in a group in space. So this, again, I'll read the article's name. SpaceX and OneWeb tell FCC their broadband mega constellations can coexist. The subtitle is the competitors have been quite cooperative recently. Okay, so this is by Josh Dinner, published 8 hours ago, so it's published on June 21st, 2020. And here's a picture of a SpaceX Falcon rocket launches 53 of the company's Starlink internet satellites from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida on May 18th, 2022. I didn't even know that was happening. Okay, SpaceX and OneWeb say their satellite internet constellations can coexist. The companies have written a joint letter to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, FCC, declaring harmony in low Earth orbit, or LEO, for spectrum coordination between their respective current and next generation broadband constellations. In the letter, which is dated June 13th, and let me just stop here because if I don't mention it now, I might forget about it. But last week and the week before, I read on who has the most satellites in space. Number one, it's Elon Musk by quite a few, by a big number. Then it's the US, then something like China and Russia. But something makes me suspicious. I don't think the US would really come up and tell us the truth about some of this. It might have more. It might have more of this, more of that, more weapons, more space-based weapons. And they don't tell us, so I think there's probably some secrets here. In the letter, which is dated June 13th, SpaceX and OneWeb request that the FCC disregard previously filed dissenting comments regarding spectrum coordination in LEO, which is low Earth orbit. SpaceX and OneWeb both submitted proposals for their first generation internet constellations to the FCC in 2016, followed by a second round of proposals in 2020 for each company's next generation broadband satellites. Simultaneously, both SpaceX and OneWeb submitted complaints with the FCC in attempt to get a leg up on each other. Now it seems the companies are operating on friendlier terms. That's nice to know. Now here's a video. It says SpaceX ready to launch, and it might not have any interesting things, so I won't play this video. Some of these videos are interesting. This one might just show a rocket being launched. To date, SpaceX has launched more than 27 of its Starlink satellites to LEO and has received FCC approval to bring that number up to 12,000. However, SpaceX's next generation Starlink constellation, which will feature larger satellites launched by the company's huge Starship vehicle, may eventually harbor up to 30,000 spacecraft. OneWeb has received similar permissions from the FCC for its plans to build a constellation of 648 broadband satellites and has expressed hopes to eventually bring that number up to 7,000 with upgraded spacecraft versions. The British startup has launched over half of its first generation satellites, but the progress slowed earlier this year due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. OneWeb has been launching its satellites aboard Russian-built Soyuz rockets. However, that partnership dissolved in the wake of the invasion, leaving OneWeb without a launch provider. In response, OneWeb turned to SpaceX, a competitor in the satellite internet market. In the first sign of easing tensions between the companies, OneWeb announced in March that it had awarded SpaceX a launch contract to help complete its first generation constellation. Now the two companies are taking another cooperative step. So says the companies in a joint letter to the FCC, and quote, after extensive good faith coordination discussions, SpaceX and OneWeb are happy to inform the commission that they agree that their respective first round systems can efficiently coexist with each other and that their respective second round systems can also efficiently coexist, the companies wrote in a joint letter. Now here's another video. 34 OneWeb satellites launch atop Ariane Space Soyuz. They request that the regulatory commission negate all prior file comments by either party against SpaceX's and OneWeb's 2016 processing round and 2020 processing round applications. And in light of their newfound harmony, SpaceX and OneWeb request that the FCC quickly approve each second round so that they can may begin deploying these cutting-edge systems. See how advanced the U.S. up to us. For SpaceX, second round approval would mean clearing another hurdle towards an operational Starship mission. Starship, the company's massive new spacecraft under development, passed an environmental review by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration earlier this month, putting the vehicle one step closer to an orbital test flight. SpaceX founder and CEO Elon Musk recently tweeted a video depicting Starship's planned PES-like deployment of the heftier Starlink 2.0 satellite, which will be too massive for either SpaceX Falcon 9 or Falcon Heavy rockets to launch efficiently. So this is an interesting article. I keep saying interesting. What should I use instead? I'll surprise you later. So again, this article is called SpaceX and OneWeb tell FCC their broadband mega constellations can coexist. It is by Josh Dinner, published June 21st, 2022, and the competitors have been quite cooperative recently. So I don't have to tell you how excited I am about the future of not just space travel, but space exploration. And I think what has gotten me very interested lately is the Artemis program to the moon, because they seem to be advancing and doing things in steps that would lead me to believe maybe they'll get kind of close to their 2025 target date of landing people again on the moon, which would include a woman and a person of color. So why not do this? Just a woman of color. That would be cool. So have a Caucasian woman step on the moon, and at the same time have this woman of color step on the moon, and a man of color. So that would be a great trio to bring us to the future. So as I said, I'm very happy that there is work that continues on the Artemis program. And as you see, Elon Musk is really very involved in this thing about working in space, not just with the with its regular program, but also doing a lot of satellite works. So I can't imagine a more exciting life in terms of all the projects he has going than Elon Musk. So it is quite exciting that Elon Musk is doing all these things. So I talked about the planetary alignment, how the moon in various steps will swing by the planets in this last week of, in the last 10 days of June. And if we get to see it, wouldn't that be grand? Now here's an interesting thing. In the new Disney Pixar movie, Lightyear, time gets bendy. Is time travel real or just fiction? So they talked about how this, in this movie, they worked with NASA. So NASA gave them some advice, and it's nice to see. So I guess Buzz Lightyear is going to, he's going to get stranded on a faraway planet, and it looks like they're going to explore the thing of light speed, and can it ever happen? So we've seen a lot of it on movies and TV where people jump into hyperspace, or their warp drive does this and their warp drive does that. So thank you for listening. This has been another edition of Astro Talk from Marco on CITR 101.9.
I am a Sirius Rhythm Machine. Now try pleasure. www.citr.ca. You win. CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.